It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Researchers at UW-Eau Claire expand their work at points around the globe and here in Wisconsin using ground-penetrating radar to identify potential unmarked mass graves. And in countries like Lithuania, it helps to locate where atrocities occurred in the Holocaust. You can call in with a question. You can share perspectives at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Harry Joel is a professor of geography and anthropology at UW-Eau Claire. Harry, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much. Thanks for the interest.
So for years, you have helped locate remains buried decades earlier in Wisconsin and across the world, and you use Pulse Echo, this commercially available deep ground penetrating radar equipment. How did you come to use this technology for finding unmarked burial sites?
Originally the technology was developed during the Apollo missions to land on the moon. And it's interesting, we're going back to the moon. But as soon as I started using this equipment, there's always an interest of locating unmarked grave sites. And even within cemeteries or out in fields in different locations. And so we've done it from an archaeological sense, such as Israel, where grave sites can be thousands of years old, all the way to places like the Holocaust and even within within Wisconsin, Potter Fields.
You know, you've been using this technology for three decades in your research. Has it evolved? Has it improved?
The electronics have improved. Back when I was starting it, a lot of it was analog, and we got some of the first digital systems out there. And so from an electronics point of view, just like, you know, laptops were developed at the same time, these radar systems were. And so we've seen laptops get smaller and smaller, and now we have smartphones, and now you can actually run some of the radar systems from smartphones.
Wow. I'm trying to think of something analogous in my life. Like, you know, is ground penetrating radar like having an ultrasound in a doctor's office? Like, just though that this is like high frequency radio waves looking into the ground to form images. Would that be analogous?
Yeah. I mean, we're dealing in the electromagnetic spectrum, like you mentioned, radio waves. So we're talking, you know, Claire here is, you know, 88.3. That is the electromagnetic frequency that we put into the ground at the same idea. When we go to the hospital, we're getting a variety of different imaging into our bodies, and we're using the same algorithms. You were talking about AI last hour. So that AI is doing some of that interpretation at the hospital, as well as on computer screens, as well as all the whole gaming industry is using the same algorithms.
This technology can give you glimpses of what may be underneath the surface without disturbing the ground. How is this an advantage when searching for unmarked graves?
Looking for graves is often a sensitive issue in a lot of different cultures. When we work with Native populations, First Nations from Canada, and then as we move into such as the Holocaust work using Jewish law, Halakha, the idea that this tragedy has already happened, we're not going to excavate to cause another tragedy. While other cultures, such as Christian cultures and Muslim cultures that we've worked with, the idea of finding the bodies, excavating them, and repatriate them to the families becomes important.
Harry Joel is with us, UW-Eau Claire Professor of Geography and Anthropology, as we talk about the technology used to locate unmarked grave sites. You can join in with your questions and your thoughts at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. You return from Cyprus, the island nation in the Mediterranean. Hundreds of Greek and Turkish Cypriots disappeared in clashes in the 60s and during the 1974 Turkish invasion. How were you able to assist in the search for victims?
They're part of a network, but the Committee for Missing Persons in Cyprus uses bilateral. So you have Greek Cypriots and Turkish Cypriots that work together and that we work with. And there's sites that are identified by survivors or by witnesses who said somewhere over there I saw the killing, or I know the killing took place over there. And often these sites are so large that you can't just excavate the whole field. And so our job is to try to narrow that in, and if we can, identify potential sites for excavation. They have like 7 to 8 excavation crews going every single day, and they're trying to locate and repatriate these bones, anthropological analysis, forensic science. I've worked with a lot of different teams. This is probably the most well-tuned and well-oiled machine of trying to locate missing persons due to past conflicts.
I wonder how do countries or commissions contact you for a potential scan project?
We've done a lot of projects, been on a, you know, have different news sources that have covered our work, as well as publications by myself and my students. We have done a lot of work, and I try to encourage the students to publish at conferences and publish papers if they're so interested. We're at Eau Claire, we're an undergraduate institute, so we're not working with graduate students. And so we've worked with a variety of different institutes. And so doing searches, or I've met them at conferences, or just by word of mouth of, you know, I've worked with Harriet here, that may be a potential location. And so I try to run a lot of workshops for these organizations, because I really want to work myself out of a job. I want this to be done by the country or the organization within the country.
I want to work myself out of a job. That's so interesting. And, you know, you worked with the Cyprus Committee on Missing Persons, as you mentioned. How difficult is your work in disputed areas where national animosities are still present?
We work with that bilateral committee and bilateral people in the field. And I don't feel that there's still some animosity that's mm-hmm. there, but with the people I'm working with and their connections with their local populations, everything has been very positive in the field. And it's actually been impressive to see understanding of what, let's say, the world looks at this like versus being on the ground. We're working with the United Nations there, so that allows us to get in and out and through the borders with the equipment. And both sides are very, very well connected, and allows us to move smoothly to get to these sites. Even at the airport, as we're leaving, they said, oh, you're part of the team with Committee for Missing Persons, because they know this is happening in the country. Everyone knows.
Wow. Well, what happens after you've finished your investigation at a site? You know, what are the steps after that?
So what we meet with the members. There's 3 members of the committee, and one is from the Turkish Cypriot side, one's from the Greek Cypriot side, and one's from the United Nations through the International Red Cross. And we give our reports verbally and talk about those. They make decisions almost on the spot of where they're going to excavate. So the teams then would excavate, provide reports. If bodies are found, those are passed to the anthropological lab. A complete assessment is done. Samples are sent for DNA to a lab in the United States. And then that results is tried to link up with family members, brothers, sisters, wives, parents, things like that. And then the bones, through social workers and psychologists, work with the families, as well as imams and priests, to return the bodies for burial.
Harry Joel is a geography and anthropology professor at UW-Eau Claire, as we explore this work using deep ground penetrating radar to help locate buried human remains. Call in to share your thoughts. You can ask a question at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. We'll be right back. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn how ground-penetrating radar technology is used to detect possible unmarked graves in Wisconsin and sites across the globe. You can call in with a question, share thoughts at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. This research at UW-Eau Claire is led by Harry Joel, a geography and anthropology professor. We are also joined by one of Harry Joel's undergraduate students, Sasha Kavaznik, who is a geography major. Sasha, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thank you. I'm really excited to be here today.
So in July, you were among a group of Harry students investigating suspected mass graves of Holocaust victims in Latvia and Lithuania. And I understand your great-great-grandmother grew up in a Lithuanian village where hundreds of Jews were massacred. How did you process that history as you took part in this project?
Yeah, it was a pretty intense experience for me. So I'm a conservative Jew. I grew up in St. Paul in the Twin Cities. And yes, I'm the fourth generation in the United States. And growing up, I learned about the Holocaust, but my parents didn't really talk about it. And so I had no idea when we got there that these locations would be truly unmarked. I mean, they were public beaches, public parks. Some were cemeteries that had graves that were unmarked, but people were walking around enjoying their day with no idea that they were potentially standing on these mass graves.
What was your role in the project? What were your days like?
Yeah, our days were long. We got going every morning pretty early, and we were out in the field all day obtaining data, honestly, as much as we could gather. You know, we were only going to be in these places just for either a couple of days and definitely just some of these places just this one time. So trying to obtain information not only for the communities, you know, the Jewish communities in the United States, but also the Jewish communities that exist in these towns, and providing information for potentially representing the Lithuanian collaboration that occurred during the Holocaust, acting as public reminders, placing memorials in these different countries.
You talked about different terrain that you were scanning and using this technology on. I'm just wondering, did you have to like ensure that you weren't working in fields where you'd have to deal with the, you know, any types of barriers in the environment? Or could you scan like anywhere, concrete, grass, forest? What about the terrain?
Yeah. So what's so amazing about the tools that we were using is you can use them in all different types of landscapes and environments. So we were able to use these tools at a beach, a public beach, where there were sand dunes. We were on the Baltic Sea. We were able to obtain information there. We were also, again, able to obtain information in the forest, locations that maybe had a rock that symbolized the people that were murdered in that place, but no other true evidence, no science to back up these eyewitness testimonies.
Your great-great-grandmother, as you said, didn't talk much about life prior to emigrating to the United States. How did your family understand its history in Lithuania?
Yeah, so this trip honestly unmasked a lot of my ancestral history. I got a hold of my family tree, and that was how I found out that Rebecca, my great-great-grandma, was from Lithuania. And while we were in one of the towns called Shaduva, I had received a message that I potentially had family from that small town. In the early 1900s, there was about 2,500 Jewish people in this town. And right before the Holocaust, there was 700, and they were all executed in just a matter of a couple of days. So I was running up and down this cemetery. All the tombstones were written in Yiddish and in Hebrew and had been wiped away, and many of them destroyed. And so it was really an incredible experience for me to be in this place where my family potentially was from, and to learn about it in person, because you can only read so much in a book or learn about things in a classroom. To physically be there and be retracing the steps of my ancestors was unreal for me.
Wow. I would imagine you took a lot of pictures of any markers that existed.
Oh, I am a photographer. I love to take pictures. My grandpa, Walter Kavaznik, was a really well-known photographer in the St. Paul area. Mm-hmm. Did a lot of weddings, lots of Jewish weddings, graduation pictures, you name it. And so I've just always been really passionate about photography. I probably took over 150 pictures at every site we went to.
We're talking with UW-Eau Claire geography major Sasha Kovaznik as we look at studying burial sites around the world. Harry Joel with us, UW-Eau Claire professor of geography and anthropology. Harry, your largest project has involved searching for mass graves of Jews killed in the Holocaust. Why involve students in these investigations?
I'm a strong believer in fieldwork as a transformative learning experience for students. And you could go back for 30 years of students who's been in the field. I still get emails from students every year who've been in the field and saying how transformative that was and allowed them to pursue careers that they never thought they could just because of the confidence they've gained. But I also think the field is also a place where you meet with people and you gain relationships very, very quickly. And these are your future, you could say, partners, future business partners, future people that you're going to come in contact with. And we're also solving problems for in-country partners. And so they realize that this is not something it's just for here. You are also passing the data on to the local communities.
I think about your two titles as geography and anthropology, and I'm just curious what you why you think it might be important for anthropologists to use this geophysical surveying method.
Well, I think within the geosciences, we have a lot of different tools, and I think it becomes more and more important that we use these tools cross-disciplinary. And a lot of the people I work with, you know, are in history or in different fields, and they often are not aware of these tools or what these tools can do. And so I'm trained as a physical geographer looking at coastal systems. I love Lake Superior. That's where I love to go work. But some of this work is you could say, more important because it's cross-disciplinary and working with these community groups that are still looking to solve problems that are, you know, decades old, hundreds of years old, thousands of years old.
Sasha, there are local efforts in Eastern Europe to put up memorials honoring Jewish victims where they were buried. What value do you see in historic markers and memorials at these sites?
Yeah, so I think memorials can not only be a reminder for people and tourism, for people to come visit these locations in which potentially their families were murdered, but also to help educate the communities that surround these memorials, you know, to teach the generations that these events did occur and we should memorialize these graves to teach the next generations. Because by ignoring these difficult topics, by not memorializing the dead, what are we teaching those next generations? We're risking that the Holocaust could reoccur.
And you plan to share the research you did in Eastern Europe at a conference. You know, what are some central things you want to share and convey?
Yeah, I'm very excited to be going to a conference. I'll be giving an oral presentation at GSA Connects in Pittsburgh. And I'm hoping just to spread awareness and educate people about Judaism, about how you can use geophysics to identify Jewish mass graves and how potentially people could use those techniques globally to identify other graves, help teach about, again, those tragic histories that are so difficult to teach about.
You anticipate to graduate from UW-Eau Claire with a Bachelor's of Science in Geography and a minor in Biology. What could I ask? What do you hope comes next?
Oh my gosh, that is a loaded question.
on the radio, no less.
Yes, I am interested in so many different topics. Mostly, I love to make maps. So this project really tapped into my cartography skills, my mapping skills, just that relationship between people, space, and place. I also am very passionate about the relationship we have with animals. So I'm not really sure what direction I'm going to go in. Conservation work, it could be Holocaust work. You know, I really don't know quite yet.
Wow. So many skills. It seems quite wide open there. Sasha, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That is Sasha Kovaznik, who studies geography and biology at UW-Eau Claire. Harry Joel is a UW-Eau Claire professor of geography and anthropology, stays with us for more conversation about the breakthroughs in ground-penetrating radar. You can be part of the discussion along the way. Call in with a question. You can bring your comments. The number to join in is 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Ground-penetrating radar is a technology behind the identification of unmarked burial sites from Latvia and Lithuania in the Holocaust to clashes on the island of Cyprus decades ago to here in America on the grounds of former Native American boarding schools. You can join in the conversation, call in with a question, add your viewpoints. The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Harry Joel is a UW-Eau Claire geography and anthropology professor leading research that uses ground-penetrating radar and stays with us. Let's bring in Eugene now in Biola. Eugene, hi.
Good morning. We have a part of the village here across the river that's called Mound Park. There were Indian mounds there, and the early settlers built on them or next to them 150 years ago, and it's never been excavated, to my knowledge anyways. If there would be an interest, then you could get a hold of the village office.
Eugene, thank you. Harry, how are you working with local tribes?
We've been doing workshops, and then we've also been out to different sites where we have an ask. We don't go to sites without that invitation, and we've often go through ceremony just so that the ancestors know we're going to be working in the area, and it's often trying to locate potential sites, and then if there's going to be development in the region or if they want to just say, okay, this is the region we're going to put a fence around. When we've worked with Maori populations, that's often what's happened is a fence goes around that area. And then, there's continuing of, let's say, sheep going through the area or things like that. But by invitation, looking at these sites is often the way we proceed and say, okay, what is of interest? What could radar do? What are other tools that could be done at that area as well?
You have consulted with Native American tribes to locate grave sites, and that work includes boarding schools here in the United States and in Canada where children are believed to be buried. How important to tribes is knowing what became of their people?
I would think there's a running theme through this work. It's people wanting to know where their ancestors are and to you could say memorialize them, identify these areas, these locations to prevent any future development as we've seen at some sites, and or just to have a place for families to go to acknowledge and mourn the loss of their ancestors. And so radar is one of these tools that could help identify there. And it's a tool, not the tool, that can be used. And I think we need to have a suite of tools to be able to take a look at these and use these tools properly. And that's part of why I like to try to get workshops and say what can and cannot be done as we move forward. Because the realization is that many tribes in both the U.S. and Canada have their own radar systems. It's a matter of, just like many companies, you lose those employees or those tribe members become employees in other sections, and we lose that skill set.
What are some of the complementary tools, as you say, that would go in tandem with ground-penetrating radar?
In this country, as well as other countries, we have a suite of aerial photos. So you can see when the ground has been disturbed. And sometimes these photos are taken yearly. We know that when over the process over years, the ground will often sink as the body decomposes. And we often have to think, okay, what's happening during this process? And then, you know, in modern day cemeteries, they put soil down and then more grass on top. Well, you can see that if you use some tools like LIDAR. A lot of places in the United States have LIDAR coverage with high enough resolution. You can see these depressions. Other tools, people would get buried with items. And so magnetics can be used, electrical resistivity tomography. And so there's a suite of tools that we can use to do a lot of this type of work.
I wonder about like tree roots and animal holes burrowing down. I mean, those can disturb the soil as well. How do you decipher soil that has been altered by people?
And this is the very difficult problem, is that in the press and a lot of other areas, is this idea that every potential image of a burial is a burial. And I hesitate to do that. I take a look at it as trained as a physical geographer, is if it's in a coastline, it should have coastal layering. And then if you disturb that layering, then that's more likely to be a burial than a rock or a tree root. But in many locations here in the Midwest, we have a lot of, you know, rocks left over from the glaciers. And then we also have tree roots, and those have been interpreted as burials when they're not.
With ground-penetrating radar, Native American graves were discovered under a church parking lot on the Lac des Flambeaux Reservation in northern Wisconsin. The church has agreed to remove a building and restore the burial site. How often does that happen after a burial site is discovered?
I mean, that's happening, I think, as we, you know, as a conversation, do we, certain cultures accept the idea of their ancestors to be, you know, the bones to be repatriated, to be excavated. Other cultures do not. And so that has to, and certain tribes, First Nations that I've worked with, some will and some will not. We had up in Manitoba where they excavated several anomalies as well. And did not discover bones at those sites. And other sites, they are finding bones. It's this trying to get this skill set. This is a relatively new field, and trying to get that better and better as we go forward.
I wonder your approach to scanning a site when you do see mounds that are visual, that you can see on the landscape, versus a large site where there are no visible clues on the landscape. Do you approach those in different ways?
Yeah, I mean, I think the higher the resolution or the tighter the lines, because what we do is basically put a whole bunch of lines together and then put that into a 3D cube. It's almost like gaming. And then you can go into that cube and take a look for features, because not all mounds have burials in them. We looked at several mounds that don't have, you know, they can be built for other purposes, effigy mounds and things like that. And so same thing as when we're looking for burials in a potential field. The more we know, the better. But to do a big, let's say, soccer field is going to take weeks and weeks of data collection. And so to get the right resolution that you need. And I often put it to, like, if you go imaging at the hospital, do you only want, you know, part of your body imaged? Or if it's a whole body, it's going to take a lot longer. And you want it at high resolution, so it's even going to take longer. And so we got to make sure we collect the data to be able to interpret what we are looking for.
Harry Joel is with us, UW Eau Claire Professor of Geography and Anthropology, as we explore his research locating unmarked burial sites and using ground-penetrating radar. You can join in with your questions. You can share your thoughts along the way. 800-642-1234. Harry, you've used radar in existing cemeteries. When is more information needed about where graves are located inside cemeteries?
In our present-day cemeteries, with a lot of them filling up, there are people in the past who have bought, let's say, two or three plots for family members, and those family members have been buried elsewhere. So there's two or three empty plots, but they don't know by records or records lost if someone else was buried at that site or not. Or I've been in examples where a certain individual wanted to be buried with their horse. Hmm. So the horse was buried next to them. And now they would like that spot to be able to use for, you know, other individuals to be buried. And so it's trying to find where those sites are.
You're doing this work on a potter's field in Dunn County. What is a potter's field?
So this is something I did not know about. And the potter's field is where people at that time, what we would call an insane asylum, where people were coming back off, you know, world wars. What would today we would call PTSD, or other people in those institutes where family members would have basically said, you're in the institute, those individuals die, they have no family support, and they get buried in this field near the asylum. I mean, Laura Ingalls Annett was buried in this one. So there's a lot of different individuals. And then as well in Dunn County, the poorhouse was right on the other side. And so you have individuals buried in the potter's field, both from the poorhouse and from the asylum.
What does your project entail in that situation? What are you trying to do?
Well, it's multipurpose. We, again, were asked by the local community to come in, and Sophie and Dave have encouraged us to work at this site. We've had several student projects to work at this site. And to go training, and we're going to go in a week and a half to go up there, and it's all new students who take a look at how do we collect data and how do we get that through, and then they'll work through that data through the next year and then present it at our annual student conference with the results. And then those results go back to the community, and then the idea is to put markers on the graves that we know are there.
How do you train up students who've never encountered this technology, never encountered this work? What is that training like?
We do there's some readings. I've tried to, with a colleague, write an intro. What is ground penetrating radar? And then most of it is hands-on. I really think getting out into the field, getting the equipment into the students' hands, getting them up and running from a tech point of view, they're very tech savvy. It's now, well, how do we collect data from a scientific point of view, and how do you collect it correctly and setting it up and taking that time? And then it's basically time in the field, as Sasha was mentioning, long days in the field collecting the data and then start processing it at night.
Hmm. Are there particular skill sets that students who succeed at this work have?
I think an interest and mm-hmm. then wanting to step out of your comfort zone. So the students on my teams are not just geography students. I mean, we've had religious studies, we've had, you know, secondary education, we've had special ed, we've had students in geology, we've had students in biology. So it's students of interest. And I just, in all my classes, I do a short 20-minute talk on the Holocaust and the work we're doing. And I said, if you're interested, come see me. And that's often, you know, some of those students are the ones that join the team and join.
The jumping off point. Harry Joel, geography and anthropology professor at UW-Eau Claire. You can call in to ask a question. You can share your insights at any point, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with UW-Eau Claire geography and anthropology professor Harry Joel, who has been using ground-penetrating radar at over 1,200 sites across the world through decades of research projects identifying unmarked burial sites, sites of atrocities. Call in to bring up your question. You can share your views at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Harry, looking to the future, this technology is commercially available. You mentioned our phones and our pockets also becoming much more powerful. And then AI, how is artificial intelligence potentially contributing to this work and this field of geosurveying?
I think a lot of it is, you know, the visualization tools that we use. I mean, AI is being used at the hospitals for that visualization after you image, you know, a body. We're doing the same thing in the ground. So when we're collecting this data in the ground, how can we have this technology be able to figure out, okay, is this a tree root? Is this a rock? Is this a burial? What kind of rules can we put in place to try to help make those interpretations?
Is concrete at all an issue for you? Or when you don't have that natural ground and you have layers of concrete or other materials, can you still do this type of work?
Yeah, I mean, concrete, all our highways in the United States are imaged by ground-penetrating radar to figure out if they're weathering or if there's voids underneath. And so often we'll see highways only ripped apart in sections, not the whole highway. And so that's some of the radar and other thermal imaging that be able to identify those sites. And so we can see things underneath. We could also look at rebarb. So look at bridge decking and things like that. We could figure out exactly where that rebarb is and see what the problems are. And so it can be used for a lot of infrastructure work. I don't do a lot of that work, but it's being used a lot to do that. So we do image on top of parking lots to look for things underneath.
You mentioned also coastal systems. And, you know, I'm wondering, you know, and how lake water rises, causes erosion. How can this technology you're using, you know, to find burial sites also be used to find solutions to environmental problems?
So we've used it for many years, everything from, as you mentioned, take a look at lake level changes. And I use Lake Superior as a laboratory for what's happening to sea level rise in Florida and North Carolina and the West Coast. I'm taking a group of students out to the Pacific Northwest in 2 weeks on a field seminar. And we're going to be taking a look at earthquakes, what earthquakes do to coastlines, and then those potential tsunamis that have come inland. And we've imaged all that. We've imaged 9 earthquakes in the Pacific Northwest, and we know exactly what happened in the Pacific Northwest during that time period. So we can start using this. We've used it, you know, in China, and we've used also in different New Zealand, Australia. So taking a look at different coastlines around the world is an important thing for the future.
What, with these images, what type of story could they tell about coastlines?
So an example of up on the Duluth Barrier System, where we are having erosion happening during high water, we can take a look at this system and seeing how much it's prograded or built out over the last couple thousand years and try to figure out how that happened, when that happened, where did the sediment come from as we urbanize some of these areas and prevent flow of sediment coming from the north or the south. And so we've seen some significant changes over the past 30 years that we've taken students up there.
I wonder, too, can it predict a bit about what the future holds in terms of sediment and any vision based on what you can see from the past?
Yeah, I'm working with a group, the Park Point Community Association, and that's some scientists and concerned community members, and we work with the Corps of Engineers and others, because we know that the Superior Duluth Harbor is a multi-billion dollar economic input into that area, and it brings a lot of resources into the Midwest. Mm. But on the other hand, the barrier system is eroding, so we need to protect that. And if we don't protect that, that harbor is gone.
Let's bring in Marianne in Madison. Hi, Marianne.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead.
Doctor, I just wanted to thank you. It's especially poignant to me because today is Indigenous Peoples Day. I want to thank you for the work you're doing. I work with, I teach for Nobody Homicides, both internationally and nationally, and I know how much your work means to people from a modern perspective of people who've had family members going missing and how much the ground penetrating radar can assist in getting people answers. So just as somebody in kind of a related field, I just want to give you my gratitude and thank you for what you and your students are doing. It's making a difference in the world.
Marianne, thank you for the call. Harry, how heavy is the responsibility you feel to interpret the readings diligently and carefully?
I mean, we take those, you know, very seriously. It's a matter of taking a look at these, putting in the context of the information we know from our in-country partners or what's happened in the past, those other tools that we talked about. And then as we move forward, things like environmental DNA is now possible. Work with a colleague down in Madison. And what are these steps we have to put together to try to put this, forward, to try to answer some of the questions that Mary Ann's put forward. I mean, the Bureau of Indian Affairs under earlier administration has now have a unit to take a look at this on tribal lands. And one of the tools that we've talked to them about that they have using now is radar, but also drones. Drone imagery can be amazing at some of these really remote locations that are large, and trying to pinpoint some of these locations for the more detailed work.
Let's bring in Joan in Superior. Joan, what is your question?
Well, I'm just wondering what kind of topography that you can use this in. I'm thinking of a cemetery in Douglas County that probably hasn't had a burial since the 1940s that is totally overgrown with huge, huge towering pine trees.
Mm.
And can you get into a place like that, or does it have to be, a field compared to something out, you might as well say, in the middle of the woods?
Yeah, I mean, we've worked in all kinds of areas, Joan, and often if it's, grass, we can go through it, or sometimes we'll trim it all down in those areas. We go in and around logs. Some of the sites, the Holocaust ones, are similar to what you're talking about, where nothing has been to the sites, and you've had trees growing up in that area. And so we have to basically work up and around some of these trees, and hopefully we make notes of where those trees are, so we know if there are root-like features in the subsurface, we acclaim that to the roots themselves. But we also know that sometimes people will plant trees on top of bodies as a remembrance, as a memorial to that individual. So we got to take a look at it both ways.
So you don't need to clear topography in order to do the scans. You work around and through the topography.
Correct. We take laser leveling of all our sites. So we have a 3D map of each of our sites.
Oh, okay. Fascinating. Harry, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your research.
Thank you. Thank you for the interest.
Harry Joel is a geography and anthropology professor at UW-Eau Claire. And earlier, we talked with UW-Eau Claire geography major Sasha Kovaznik. If you missed any part of our conversation, you can stream it. You can download a recording later today. Go to wpr.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Confidence in the scientific community is in decline among adults in our country. That polling from NORC at the University of Chicago and the Associated Press, we explore what the purpose of scientific education should be like with a longtime science educator who joins us. And you can join the conversation at any point, calling in with a question, sharing your viewpoint, 800-642-1234, email ideas at wpr.org. John Rudolph is a distinguished professor of science education at UW-Madison School of Education, author of Why We Teach Science and Why We Should. John, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, thanks so much, Kate. Very glad to be here.
You say the way Americans teach science in K-12 schools is largely ineffective. What are those biggest myths associated with how we teach science?
Yeah, the what we've been focusing on more recently is just this idea that we need to teach students the content, the disciplinary content, the knowledge, the sort of problem solving skills. So I guess the three biggest myths that are that that science education is primarily to prepare students for these science-related careers. We hear this all the time with getting students in the STEM pipeline.
There's a pipeline. There's a pipeline, John Rudolph.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, that's the biggest myth, I think, of all of them. But then the other things that teachers will say or the public will say is that, well, the facts of science are useful. It's utilitarian. It helps people in their daily lives, in their roles as citizens. That's another one that you really need to look at a little more carefully. And the third one is this belief that science education helps students develop critical thinking skills, better thinking skills. Science is this epitome of rational thought. And if we have students do science, do more laboratory activities, that they'll somehow absorb this rational thinking and use it in their daily lives. Those are the big three that I see.
And this rational, better thinking, that apparently they don't absorb it. Like we really lose this information once we like memorize it, then it's gone, you found.
Yeah, I mean, so the fact, I mean, there's so much of what goes on in science classrooms is about getting students to memorize the stages of mitosis or the parts of the cell or the periodic table of the elements and this kind of fact-based science teaching, which we've gravitated towards because of this emphasis on standardized assessments. And this will get students to do well on their tests and ACT scores and whatever. But it's not useful information. It's not information that people actually, number one, they don't remember it. Various studies have shown that nearly half of the content students learn in their science classes, they simply don't recall. And in many cases, if they do recall it, it's not obvious how they would actually use it in their daily lives. That's another big challenge.
Like not even the physicians remember the basic science. I mean that, people in the scientific community not being able to recall some of these things that they were taught in school.
Well, right. So those were two studies that were done at one at MIT with physics majors, another study done with medical students. These were people who were going to be scientists, and they found that about 60% of the content that they learned, they lost after not even 4 years of, they begin their studies by their senior year, they've already forgotten over half of it. But more damning is the studies by the National Science Foundation. They do these surveys every couple of years where they just survey public knowledge of science content. And we find that fewer than half the general public know, for example, that electrons are smaller than atoms. It's very basic scientific facts. And over a quarter of the public believes that the sun goes around the earth and not the earth around the sun, for example.
How does that make you feel?
Well, two things. One is that I guess the key, which got me thinking, was that these facts that we teach really don't matter that much for people's daily lives, that people go along with their lives very successfully. And it doesn't really matter whether they think the sun goes around the earth or the earth goes around the sun. And so it made me rethink, well, what is the purpose of teaching science if it's not to get students or people to learn all these facts that don't seem to be very applicable to their daily lives?
We're talking about how and why Americans teach science in schools. We have John Rudolph, UW-Madison School of Education professor, and you can be part of the conversation. Your questions, your insights, welcome at 800-642-1234. John, what are the two goals or tiers, as you call them in the book, of teaching science in high school?
Yeah, so in the book, I look through sort of the commonly given purposes of teaching science. And these are things you can really break them down into a science for culture argument, like teaching science to convey a sense of appreciation of the beauty of the natural world and the ability of human beings to have figured this all out. So that's one. Science education for better thinking, this belief that science education leads to problem-solving skills, critical thinking skills that we just talked about. The science education for utility argument that the facts of science are useful in daily life or for national economic growth and prosperity, and science education for democracy. Mm. This idea that increasing scientific and technological world, that citizens need to understand the basics of science in order to participate in the democratic process. And the tiers that you mentioned are essentially, we focus on a tier one, which is mostly about having the STEM pipeline argument, that we focus on thinking about preparing students for advanced courses in science, because we think that that will lead to careers that will be prosperous for them and the nation. The tier two is sort of the science for general education, which we talk about, but we don't really emphasize. This is the notion, these are the science for democracy, science education for cultural appreciation, science education for better thinking arguments. Hmm. And of the two, we pay lip service to both of these, but what we end up focusing on is this technical training argument, which is, we see it in school programs that have engineering courses and biotech courses and AP courses, because we want to prepare these students for their future careers or occupations.
Let's bring on a call, Rebecca in Manitowoc. Rebecca, hi. What would you like to say?
Yes, hi. Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to make the comment that I agreed with what your guest is saying, because I went back to school in my 40s for a medical degree in physical therapy. And I have to tell you that 60% of my classes and the things I was learning was rote memorization. And you memorize body parts, you memorize muscles, bones, nerves. And after, you don't retain that information if you don't understand why you're memorizing it or what it's going to be used for. And once you get into the field, there's a lot that you don't in your job that you were required to memorize. So there's a few things that could be changed in the way that we teach these subjects. And in fact, we could get rid of a lot of the things that we know someone doesn't need in their job, because I feel like universities take advantage of forcing people to pay for classes they don't need. And two, we could teach the why instead of teaching to the test. I feel like we teach to the test to pass people, but we don't teach the why. And the why is really what helps you retain it.
Rebecca, thank you so much. John, this speaks to so much in your book.
Yeah, absolutely. And so Rebecca's right on target, I think. And the why, the teaching the why, I think, is so much more important than just focusing on the facts of science, the litany of things that we ask students to memorize. And students are good at that. They can memorize, they can get right answers, they can solve problems. But then if you follow up a few weeks later or ask them really, what do they really understand? You find that all they've done is memorize. And we call this surface learning. They learn for the test and they haven't developed a deep understanding. And that deep understanding comes from students understanding where that knowledge came from. Why do we believe what we believe? What's the evidence? And that's what I think an important goal of science education should be, is how do we know what we know? What's the basis of our scientific knowledge? Not just what are the facts that we've learned so far.
UW-Madison education professor John Rudolph's book is called Why We Teach Science and Why We Should, as we discuss the place of scientific principles and concepts in our lives, how they are taught in the classrooms. Call in with a question, share your comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore how science curriculums could be reimagined to engage students in the complex connections between science and society, as opposed to memorizing the periodic table for a test. UW-Madison School of Education professor John Rudolph's latest book is called Why We Teach Science and Why We Should. And you can be part of the discussion on how science is taught. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. John, you question whether America needs more scientists. Does our country need more of them?
Yeah, so that's one of the biggest myths, and people have written about this in other places, and I try to bring this together in the book for this to address that technical training myth. And when you run the numbers, you look at, say, the beginning, like the incoming freshmen in high school across the nation. If that's 100% of students beginning secondary education at that point, then how many end up down the line in a science related occupation or career or degree? And you find that about half those students by their late 20s will have earned a degree of any kind, let's say an associate's degree or a bachelor's degree. And then of those degrees, only about 27% are in a science related field. And this is a generous estimate, including things like all the health professions, nursing, agricultural and natural resources degrees, in addition to things like engineering and physics and molecular biology and things like that. And so that takes you down to about, if you have the 50% and then 27% are in science-related degree programs, that brings you down to about 13%, 14%. But only about half those students end up in science-related careers. There's an oversupply, actually, of a lot of the various science-related careers, which means that in the end, only about 7% of all those incoming freshmen end up in sort of that technical career path in a science-related field. And so that made me think, like, what is the science education for those other 93% of the students in our classes? And if we're just having them on this technical training path that's focused on the memorization of science content, the mastery of problems within a discipline, a lot of laboratory work, it's doing those students a disservice. And that's not the kind of science education we need for citizens.
Let's bring in Jared in Madison. Jared, what's your perspective?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just like to comment on this because I am a first generation college student, and I found that, am I doing well in high school in science and doing well in my undergraduate career at a learning university didn't really prepare me for research at a research university. And I found that those around me who were succeeding and flourishing had a background and socioeconomic status much higher than mine, which led them to a lot of connections and a lot of just cultural knowledge that I just simply didn't have access to. And if we're educating people for the pipeline, simple rote memorization doesn't really accomplish that whatsoever. And getting people into that sort of cultural aspect of science and even just how do you perform science on the day-to-day just isn't really covered by our scientific education.
I understand you work as a data analyst. Do you find that your preparation for that job relates to what you do in the day-to-day at work?
So I think my research experience really helped me in terms of just being able to learn independently and being able to adapt to the situation. Specifically, I work in biotech, so obviously, it helps to know a little bit of biology.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Jared, thank you so much for your insights and for sharing about your experience. John, what do you make of Jared's story?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think that the notion of sort of cultural understanding of science is an interesting point. It's more of he's suggesting a more liberal arts approach, that science isn't just a technical field, that those facts give us everything we need in order to be successful, but there's a richer kind of learning that we might imagine that looks at the place of science in society, how scientific knowledge emerged historically, and how that knowledge has shaped the world we see around us. And that's a kind of richer sort of understanding that I think citizens and future science workers and researchers could really benefit from.
A goal of science education is to teach students these general specific principles for what educators call scientific literacy. What do you find problematic about scientific literacy?
Well, that's it's a chapter in the book that I look at the history of the concept of scientific literacy. And it emerged in right around the end of World War II, when there was a lot of concern on the part of scientists that the public didn't really understand what science was. And their worry back then was that the public saw science just as this technical field that could create these magical things like atomic weapons and radar and new innovative technologies, and that the public didn't understand sort of the ethos of science, the culture of science, the values of science. And so the idea of scientific literacy emerged around 1945 to help the public think about that. And over time, though, scientific literacy has been co-opted, and it's so appealing to just talk about scientific literacy without defining what we mean by it. And more recently, it's been measured by like the NSF science indicators that I mentioned earlier, by simply how much of the facts of science does the public know and remember. And that has become sort of the measure of scientific literacy, which is very, very different than the ideas that emerged in the post-war period about what kind of an appreciation of science the public should have. And so scientific literacy is this empty phrase that everybody says, oh, the public should be scientifically literate, but we don't ever say what we really mean by that. And it ends up defaulting to this, let's measure it by test scores.
UW-Madison School of Education, longtime professor John Rudolph's latest book, Why We Teach Science and Why We Should, 800-642-1234 to join in with your question. Let's go to Sean in Eau Claire now. Sean, hi.
I'd like to thank you for another great topic on WPR, and thank you for taking my call. This is such an interesting topic, and it can be a little confusing in ways or difficult in ways of, you know, back in high school, I remember it was common for students to think, oh, why do I need to learn algebra? Why do I need to learn physical science? I'm never going to use it. Who cares about all this history that happened? But then as we grow through life, or at least for myself, I'm 50 years old now. I've changed careers multiple times and been successful. But I was in construction. I used algebra every day, and it was something that was very important. And you know, then even science. And why do things evaporate? What happens? Why? Where's the chemical change happening here? Where at least you can draw some common sense conclusions. And then I also found that my interests have changed dramatically from the time I was 15, 16, 18 years old.
So a lot of changing and evolving, Sean, and then seeing science in different ways, John Rudolph.
Yeah, I mean, so I don't want to give the impression that science education isn't important, that the book isn't about that we should not teach science in schools. And it's the question of what are we teaching and for what goal are we teaching it and how are we teaching it? I mean, I think that's the key. And the thing that the caller is pointing out is are the kinds of understandings that we want people to have about science, not just memorizing the various boiling points and melting points of substances, but understanding what's going on conceptually. What are the models of evaporation and condensation that do we have? Are we teaching in such a way that students really understand what's going on and how that might impact their lives? Rather than just sort of rote learning for a test. And that's the main objection that I guess I'm trying to get across.
John Rudolph, Distinguished Professor of Science Education in the Department of Curriculum and Instruction at UW-Madison School of Education, examining how science classrooms could change and along the way, how to rebuild public trust in the scientific community. As we explore this topic, you can be part of it. Email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. About 7 out of every 100 students will end up working in a science-related occupation. UW-Madison science education professor John Rudolph asked the question, then how much technical training do high school students really need? His latest book is called Why We Teach Science and Why We Should. And you can bring your perspective on science classrooms. Call in with a question, add comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. John, you write about a city in Dane County that built a new high school with upgraded classrooms and technology. And you say the science department's goals on its website are disconnected from the courses that are offered. What is the disconnect going on?
Yeah, well, the if you look at the website of the science department, it lists the typical things you would see, arguments for science education. They say, oh, the students will develop better thinking skills through science. It's important to create citizens who can make decisions on complex socioscientific issues. It's all the rhetoric that we find about why we teach science. But when you look at the program itself and the courses, it's very much geared toward the STEM pipeline. They have a number of courses in, there's a program, Project Lead the Way, which is about engineering, bioengineering and mechanical engineering. They've got biotech courses. And these appeal to the school board members and the community and many of the public policy makers who are making this argument about the STEM pipeline that, oh, this keeps us competitive. This keeps us able to compete with scientists in India and China and all that. And like you mentioned, the fact that so few students actually end up in these science-related careers makes it questionable whether or not this is the kind of program we really need for the public.
You also call advanced placement a forced march through a preordained subject. What about AP courses?
Yeah, so the AP courses are, and I'm not sure if I said that or quoted someone who had said that, but I think the focus is on covering the content. The idea is that supposedly the AP course mirrors what an introductory college course in chemistry or biology would look like, and so the goal is to get students to pass the AP exam at the end of the year. And mm-hmm. So there's definitely a focus on, and this has been a longstanding critique of AP courses, that it's very test focused and test driven. And in order to cover all that material and get the students to pass those exams, the kind of teaching that goes on is very much focused on sort of a rote memorization kind of an approach. You can't really take the time to explore concepts in depth. You can't really explore how various ideas in biology or physics historically have influenced the way we see the world in a deep way. And so this it's a credential-based system that really pleases everybody. The parents are happy because they can their students can get college credit and they don't have to pay for that extra college course. The school district is happy because they feel like they're providing the service to the community. Students are happy if they pass the test. And so everybody's happy, but the knowledge that the students are learning isn't useful in a meaningful way. It becomes simply something that they just forget once they've accomplished the goal of passing that test.
Let's bring in Julie in Madison now. Julie, hi. What would you like to add?
I'm on the employer end of hiring new graduates for engineering entry level. What we find out of the teaching in the teaching universities is that the students lack independent thought and analytical skills as to how do I prove something is true or false? What's a quick way to test my hypothesis? The second defect in the educational system is that they cannot communicate what they do, find, and think to others in simple English.
Julie, thank you so much for sharing. And John Rudolph, how does that analysis, you know, inform what you're finding?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what you would expect from the kind of traditional science education that we currently have. If students are passing their tests and moving along the steps of the course progression in science just by that surface kind of learning, then if somebody asks them to explain something in more accessible everyday terms, they're not able to translate that because they don't really understand it well. They don't understand it at a conceptual level that allows them to explain it to somebody who hasn't memorized the same things they've memorized. All they can do is spout the technical ideas that they've committed to their memory. And those analytical skills are exactly the kinds of things you'd like to see more of in science classes, but that's not what traditional science education really focuses on.
In terms of communication, Julie talked about explaining the science. And you say one goal of science education should be to build public trust in science. What do you mean?
Yeah, so that's a huge one. And when I first started writing the book, that was part of the motivation. Was I had been working with pre-service science teachers for 20 years at UW-Madison. And the students all came in. They come in with undergraduate degrees in the sciences. And one of the things that I try to do is to shift how they think about what science education is about. And as I began writing the book, it was during the time of all this disinformation and misinformation, which is a huge focus these days. And it's a worry, certainly, for society. And it became clear that if all information is seen as equal in a fact-based way, that we're just learning facts and that somebody else's fact is just as good as another person's fact, that invites this kind of misinformation and disinformation. And so the focus on building trust is trying to get underneath those facts and to spend time in science classrooms exploring why do scientists believe what they believe? How did they come to know that? What's the evidence that supports those ideas? And how does science work as an enterprise? It's not just one person who says, this is true or this is false. It's a whole community of researchers that spend years processing data and information, and they come to a consensus, and that consensus formation is where the strength of science comes from. And that's something the public really needs to understand is how that knowledge is created.
How that knowledge is created and the nature, as you say, of scientific inquiry. How comfortable are teachers conveying scientific inquiry and taking science in these new directions?
Yeah, it's a huge challenge. Number one, these beginning teachers and current teachers have come through a system that hasn't taught them in that way. And so they've gone through their college courses learning in this very fact-based rote way. And not very many, some certainly, but not very many have direct firsthand experience engaging in research and doing research and really understand that. And yet policy documents and prescriptions encourage teachers then to help students understand what the scientific inquiry process is, but they themselves don't really understand what that is. And the result is they often simply just revert to textbook teaching and don't. There's all kinds of curriculum materials that have been developed over the years, beginning back in the 1950s and 60s. And these things that have tried to get teachers to focus on inquiry just end up sitting on the shelf and they're not used.
UW-Madison School of Education Professor John Rudolph with us as we examine how and why America teaches science in schools. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Hong is here from La Crosse. Hi, Hong. What would you like to add?
Yeah, first, I want to say thank you for taking my call. Somewhat, I feel like we couldn't approach everything from a real practical view. Yeah, I know practical is good. That's for our life. But if you completely view all the courses we teach at school, secondary or college, then it's not going to make sense, because I have learned chemistry, biology, physics in high school. I never used them, and I forgot everything, and I scored high. I don't like them necessarily, but I was told to learn it, and I was a good kid. Now, when I recall that period, I feel like probably the more valuable part of learning all those things is the thinking skill, like what the author said. You can approach a certain area from a different view instead of just being always use your accustomed way of thinking because you don't like it, but you still have to approach it. That might be a good life skill. And on the other side, I also feel sometimes you never know whether you're going to really use this knowledge later, because even if you are memorizing all the knowledge facts, even at that time you understand probably one third of it, but later if you really need to use it, retrieve it from your memory or approach it, you may suddenly feel, yeah, it makes sense. That's what happened to me. Although I'm never a science major person. I'm a retired teacher.
Yeah.
And then my student kept asking me, why do we need to learn this? Why do we need to learn that? I couldn't explain, because, yeah, you're not going to use it if you're not going to college. If you're going to be a cashier in the supermarket, which is a good job, no, you don't need to use it. Why do you need to learn it? I just feel like it's going to broaden your view.
Broaden your view, Hong. Thank you so much for those insights and calling in. John Rudolph, go ahead.
Yeah, what struck me from Hong's comment was how unpleasant she found her high school science courses. And it's interesting to think that students are in these courses and just simply get turned off and have no desire to learn more science or think about science in their lives. And it's really important, given all the challenges we have with clean water and climate change and global pandemics. I mean, the kind of understanding that we need is crucial. And it's not just, the steps of the immune response. That's not the kind of thing that's going to help us decide whether we should get vaccinated or not vaccinated. Understanding what the NIH is involved in and how that works, and trusting that they wouldn't develop and disseminate vaccines that would hurt the population, is, and then giving confidence that we should get vaccinated because that's good for all of us. That's the kind of understanding and trust in science that we need.
John Rudolph, educator and author, newest book, Why We Teach Science and Why We Should. There's room to discuss your insights. Call in with a question, share comments at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore a different vision of what science education could look like in Wisconsin schools and across the nation, and how coursework is falling short. Call in with a question. Bring your perspective on how science is taught. Number to join in is 800-642-1234. We have John Rudolph, Distinguished Professor of Science Education at UW-Madison School of Education. New book is called Why We Teach Science and Why We Should. Let's go to Dominic now in Madison. Hi, Dominic.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I think it's a really important topic. The question I had is that I think one of the reasons that rote learning is maybe favored is because it's so easy to measure if you just know a fact or don't know a fact. So my question for your guest is, how would he recommend that we measure the type of more deeper learning that he's thinking that we should be teaching, and that mm-hmm. I agree we should be teaching.
Dominic, thank you. How do you give grades and measure competency, John?
Yeah, I think that that's a great question. And it's not terribly difficult. The kinds of standardized assessments we have right now are really low cognitive demand. In other words, it is just recall. Can you identify a correct answer, yes or no? And so you would need different kinds of assessments that get at sort of deeper understanding. And that is simply, it takes a little more effort, but you have to be able to ask questions that ask students to apply their knowledge in a novel situation, maybe a little mini case study where they have to give an interpretation of what's going on. It's just a different mindset from the assessment perspective. And so it does require effort. So the kind of shift that I'm talking about here isn't easy. We ended up with the traditional instruction we have because it's easy right now. It's easy for teachers. It's easy for students, at least the ones that are science focused, really like to the approach of tell me what you want me to memorize and I'll memorize the steps of the Krebs cycle. And so the shift to thinking about learning in a more meaningful way and expanding the curriculum to include things that aren't just the technical aspects of science is a huge challenge. And people have been trying to change science education for over 100 years, and we haven't been very successful at it. And so it's a big, big lift. And the caller is right to point out that it would be difficult in many ways.
What about in your classrooms with these emerging teachers that you are sending out into the world? How do you approach influencing their minds of aspiring science teachers and how science should be taught?
Well, we do a lot of, they read chapters of the book. We go through the ideas in the book. We go through all different kinds of readings and data. We look at the data that says, look, not most of your students aren't going to be STEM professionals. So even though you were all on the STEM profession track, how does that force you to rethink what you're going to do with your students? And so it's very discussion based. They practice developing assessments that are assessing students' deeper understanding. And we have very small class sizes. And part of the problem with that is there's class sizes are small because there's fewer and fewer people going into science education or teaching the profession generally.
Why do you think that is?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of that has to do with the larger political climate, the compensation models for teachers. I think that teachers don't feel valued and they're not compensated like they were, and there's been a teaching shortage in science, and so the solution at the state level was to change the certification requirements from having science teachers certified in subjects like physics and biology, chemistry, and then the most recent change has been let's just call the certification all science, and so that someone with a degree in biology, if they go through a teacher certification program, they end up with a license to teach any subject, even though they might not have a lot of expertise in physics. And so there's been this sort of de-skilling, a willingness to lower standards in order to say, well, we don't have as much of a teacher shortage anymore. And that's problematic. Go ahead.
Yeah, you know, we heard Sean earlier talk about using algebra in roofing. Could your research apply to other areas like mathematics?
Well, mathematics is not my area of expertise, but I have two daughters who came up through the Madison schools, and math was a challenge for them, and it was something that they took, and I encouraged them to take, and it was mostly because the belief that, well, this is going to be important because you need to have this on your transcript when you apply to college, and they're going to expect that you've had advanced math courses. And so it was very much a credential mindset, and that's the world we live in. And so as a parent, I'm certainly not going to ignore that that reality exists. But in terms of the substance of what they learned and whether it was useful in their lives, I can't say that it was.
So what about the trust piece? You know, what is the process to be able to, have science and have that democratic decision making and that rebuilding the trust in the scientific community in our last moments here? What would you suggest?
Yeah, I think that the focus should be, if we're going to develop a science curriculum that's going to focus on building public trust, it should focus on understanding how scientists and the scientific community creates knowledge. What are the big ideas? Not what are all the ideas we need to remember, but what are the big ideas in each of the disciplines, like evolution through natural selection, the conservation of energy, these big guiding principles that are important in the various fields, and knowing how they developed. How did scientists develop and come up with these ideas? What's the evidence that they based their knowledge on? I think that's really important. And I also think that we should expand that to think about how does science work today in society? Like, how are research priorities determined? The public sits back and thinks that science just happens, but really it's the public through congressional committees and funding appropriations.
Through grants, yes.
That
set the direction. What
research gets done.
John, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, wonderful. Thank you so much for having me.
John Rudolph, Vilas Distinguished Achievement Professor of Science Education at UW-Madison School of Education, author of Why We Teach Science and Why We Should. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.